call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum present. And as a reminder to the public, the only public testimony that we'll be taking on the bills that we're going to hear tonight are from individuals who signed up in advance per the agenda posting on the committee webpage. And for those following along, we are going to change the order a little bit. We're going to start with House File 2956. It is a Representative Frazier bill. I will move to lay over House File 2956. And I already forgot the minutes. We're off to a great start. So before we get to that, do we have a motion from Vice Chair Feist to approve the minutes from March, what day are we? 21st, 2023.
So moved,
Madam. All those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Now going back to House File 2956. I think, just to be clear, I will move to lay over House File 2956. And you don't have any amendments that I see, Representative Frazier. So go ahead and explain your bill.
Oh, we do have amendments.
He doesn't, though. Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll get to that. Go ahead, Representative Frazier.
Representative Votney, eager. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill, House File 2596, seeks to expand the number of individuals on the Sentencing Guideline Commission. And the idea is to, based on studies by the Rubin Institute, and I do have a testifier here that is a part of that institution to talk about the reason behind it. But essentially, it seeks to expand and broaden the perspectives that are on the guidelines, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. So Minnesota was one of the first sentencing commissions in the nation. It was created as a small commission, and the membership has not changed much over the years. As we'll hear from testimony, the commission that followed us have included a broad range of voices on the commission. This bill seeks to take advantage of their experience and updates the membership of our commission to include three new voices: a treatment provider, an academic, and a person who has been formally convicted of a felony offense. In addition, the bill creates staggered terms for all of the members, so the commission will no longer lose the majority of its members and lose its historical knowledge with each change in gubernatorial leadership. Over time, it will also result in there always being a mix of members appointed by multiple governors, which I think is very important, which helps reduce any inference of political influence on the members. Madam Chair, if I may, there was, through the drafting process, as we know, we've got a lot of bills going through our revisor. In the initial draft, there should have been a section that was about retroactivity, and it didn't get in. But the intent is, as we lay this over and consider it, I will be bringing an amendment to add that retroactivity piece, and I'd like to speak to what it would do, what the intent of it would be, if I may. The retroactivity piece will essentially would allow, if there are any changes to the sentencing guideline that would reduce the sentence of individuals, they would be able to petition to have their sentence considered for a reduction. Now, it wouldn't require that the sentence be reduced. It would go through the same judicial review and process, and that judicial reviewer would be able to determine whether or not the sentence was appropriate or whether or not the sentence could actually be reduced on the new guideline. So I would be offering that as we go through the process as an amendment. And I am sorry that it did not make it through in the initial draft, and I didn't get an amendment in time to offer it tonight. But I wanted to make sure I provided that so that if members wanted to discuss it, they would have the opportunity to do, and it wouldn't be a shock to anyone.
All right, thank you. And I see that you do have a testifier here, Professor Perry Moriarty. Welcome back to the committee. If you want to introduce yourself, and please begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. My name is Perry Moriarty, and I am a law professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a faculty director for the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Procedure. And the Robina Institute at the University of Minnesota Law School is the only research institute in the country with expertise in all U.S. sentencing guideline systems. Robina has done research on the different guideline systems across the country, and I'm here to tell you a little bit today about that research and how the changes proposed in this bill will align our sentencing commission with those in other states. As Representative Frazier indicated, Minnesota was one of the first states in the nation to create a sentencing commission in 1978 and the first to enact sentencing guidelines. Since then, 15 other states and the federal government have created sentencing commissions with responsibility over sentencing guidelines. And several more states have commissions with broader authority over general criminal justice policy. Minnesota's commission currently has 11 members. Nationally, the average commission size is about 17 members. This bill adds some critical new voices to the commission that have become key voices on many commissions around the country. Nearly every commission includes members who are judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys, and a fair number, like Minnesota, also include victim representation. But newer commissions also include additional voices, such as legislators, treatment providers, and other experts. The additional members proposed in this bill are consistent with this trend and will align Minnesota's commission with those in many other states. The bill adds, as Representative Frazier indicated, three key new voices. The first is a person who provides treatment or rehabilitative services. And as all of you know, people who are sentenced under the guidelines and receive probation are required to engage in treatment programs during that period. Others engage in treatment while incarcerated. So a treatment perspective is a key voice that is currently missing from the guideline discussions. This is something that Utah does. Michigan's commission also included a mental or behavioral health professional, as do Alaska and Connecticut. The bill also adds an academic to the commission, a position that can bring information to the table about crime trends and the root causes of criminal behavior. Alabama, Illinois, Louisiana, and North Carolina all include a member who is an academic with a background in criminal justice or corrections. Pennsylvania seats either a law professor or a criminologist. Finally, the bill adds a person who was formally convicted of and discharged from a felony sentence. Governor Waltz has been designating one of the public positions for this role, but this bill makes the perspective a permanent part of the commission. By comparison, North Carolina's commission includes a formerly incarcerated person, and Alabama has used one of their public member positions for this purpose. Finally, the bill changes the appointing power for two of the judicial positions on the commission. This is in line with how other commissions across the country operate. The majority of commissions have a variety of appointing authorities, usually people who are closer to the interest being represented in the position. I will stop there, and I am willing to answer any questions that I can. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. And we did not have anybody from the public sign up to testify. And so before we move to member discussion, we will move to the A1 amendment. And Lead Novotny, are you offering the A1 amendment?
That is correct, Chair Morley.
All right. Please tell us about your A1.
Excuse me. The A1 amendment. The A1 amendment is our bill to offer a different look at the changes that you would like to do in this bill. Governor Wall's appointees have used the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to enact policies like a five-year cap on state sentences, which usurps the legislator's role in making laws. Rather than having governor appoint members to a commission that goes around the legislature to enact his initiatives, we have stakeholder groups directly designate their members to the commission. The County Attorneys Association and the public defender boards appoint their members. We've added a position for probation so that the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections and the Minnesota County Probation Officers can each have a designated member at the table. We changed the peace officer position to a sheriff and a police chief, both appointed by their associations. We give the legislature input by adding a public member and having four members appointed, one by each of the House and Senate majority and minority caucuses. The commission members would vote on the chair. We see this as our response to a trend that I've seen in my 3 years here where we're modifying things and we're doing commissions and we have boards that are designed just to go around the purpose and the supervision of the legislature. in the same way that some of the post-board auxiliary boards were set up. We see removing things like having the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court make these appointments in the same way that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is being removed under the proposal for the parole board. This is our plan. We'd like to have groups represented by the groups and not handpicked by one person, and that is my amendment, Chair Mueller.
Thank you. To the amendment, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Votney, the idea of this is to broaden the scope of individuals that don't have these specific perspectives that don't exist on the board now. It is not. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to be very clear about is that I didn't want to create some kind of political partisan thing here. That is why when this takes full effect, if it goes into effect, members will be able to be appointed, and there will be a mixture of members appointed by different governors. I think that's an important thing. I think what you're offering here, not only does it kind of stack the deck for particular interested parties, or it also creates that kind of political that I tried to avoid when I was drafting this legislation. And I just don't think we should go there. I think this is an important piece of legislation. I think it's an important job that this commission does, and I wouldn't want it to be impacted by any political interference. You talked earlier about how these boards are usurping the legislator, but these boards are only doing, they're exercising the power that the legislator gave them. You know, if we wanted to take certain powers away from them, we could do that, but they're exercising the power that the legislator gave them. And this is, and most of this power is not new power. It's power that's been in place for decades that they're exercising. So I don't think that that's the issue, that they're usurping the power of the legislator. They're just exercising the power that they have, and they're exercising power based on new knowledge, new information that's coming in, new trends that are coming in. And I think that we should be listening to the voices and the recommendations that are coming from these boards. This is exactly what we designed them to do. So I'm going to respectfully decline. But what I will say this, I am open to looking at possibly adding more members to the commission, and I'd like to have conversations with you about that, but I'm going to respectfully decline the number and the particular groups that you are providing for tonight, because I do believe that gets away from what we're trying to do here, and we're trying to keep this balanced but bring in new perspectives.
Further discussion on the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for your answers. I understand your position, and I can do the math, though. And I've seen the blueprint for all these committees, the Excellence in Policing and Community Relations Board, everything else that I've seen. You can add more members to this board. If they're all appointed from the same person, that's not going to change anything. And we're specifically going out of our way to eliminate people that can't be appointed by the governor because of the current statutes that have that appointed by their position. You talked about new knowledge and new things that are learned, how that has no effect on the people and how they're appointed. I would expect this board to respond to new information. That wouldn't change anything. With that, Chair Mueller, I ask for a roll call vote.
All right, a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll on the A1 amendment.
Chair Mueller?
No.
Mueller, no. Vice Chair Feist?
No.
Feist, no. Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Novotny, yes. Representative Becker-Finn?
No.
Becker-Finn, no. Representative Curran?
No.
Curran, no. Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Ingen, yes. Representative Frazier?
No.
Frazier, no. Representative Hollins?
No.
Hollins, no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Hudson, yes. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Hewitt, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, yes. Representative Witte?
Yes.
Witte, yes. With 5 ayes and 7 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 5 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the A1 amendment is not adopted. There are no other amendments, so we can move to member discussion of the bill. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for providing a earnest explanation of what it is you're trying to achieve here. I would suggest that the premise that there's some mechanism for taking the politics out of deciding how we sentence people for crime is a fundamentally flawed premise. This is not going to take the politics out of it. It's an inherently political act. It's a political act to tell somebody, we're going to impose upon you a criminal sentence. That's a political act. You're not taking the politics out of it. You're simply concentrating who gets to make that decision. And as noted by Lee Novotny, concentrating who gets to pick who makes those decisions. And it's a little bit of trying to reinvent the wheel because we already have a political body that was designed to make political decisions, and that's the legislature. I think what this bill and the discussion around it reveals is potentially a fundamental flaw in the premise for why this commission exists in the first place. As a body, we need to stop outsourcing our job to appointees who aren't subject to the veto of the people. This is something that should be subject to political wins because that's how we respond to the ever-changing needs of our community. Is through our electoral and political process. So I don't have anything to offer in the way of making this better. I think the fundamental premise of it is ill-informed, but I appreciate your work.
Further member discussion? Anything else, Lee Novotny?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So Representative Frazier, why are we removing the appointment by the Supreme Court Justice?
Representative Frazier.
So we're removing it and we're giving that appointment to the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeals. And it goes to the statements that were made in the testimony by Ms. Mariotti here is that we try to attach it to the folks closest to the individuals that we've represented it. Right now, there is a Chief Justice that represents the Court of Appeals, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court represents the Supreme Court. So we thought that providing the Chief Justice with the ability to represent to make that pick would be closer to those judges that they oversee.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Frazier, and what difference would that make? I think when the spirit of this law was written with having that oversight and what I would consider someone with, I consider the Supreme Court to be neutral, how would that make the situation better, or how would that improve the situation?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Novotny, at the appellate level, in the way our state works, almost every case can be appealed through that process. So that's a heavy volume of cases that are appealed through that process. So those judges see a multitude of different issues, criminal issues, all types of issues. So therefore, they are way much more informed than some of the judges that sit on our Supreme Court, which don't see such a heavy volume. They get a chance to pick which cases in most instances, and they do not take a majority of the cases that are submitted for petition to the Supreme Court. So in a sense, the experience and the breadth of knowledge and information that they will have based on that the litigation and the cases that they see is something that they can bring to the table, and that's why in those that Chief Justice would know exactly that information, and that's why I think it's important that they have a say in who that person is that represents them on the commission.
Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I would suspect that the members of the Supreme Court would be surprised to know that they're not informed and not involved in a daily court decision-making processes. With that, Chair, I'll request a roll call vote.
All right, and we, it's being laid over. Yeah, there'll be other opportunities. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And I did want to point out, because I realize a lot of us serve on both the Judiciary Committee and the Public Safety Committee, but not everybody. And just to point out that the Chief Justice is appointed by the governor and serves in that role until they reach the age of 70 or they step down. So that's actually a political appointee that stays there. I mean, obviously, it's the Supreme Court. We do hope that they are nonpartisan. But I do think it's important to note that that position, like right now, we have a Chief Justice who was appointed by Governor Pawlenty. That was a long time ago. Whereas the District Judges Association, you know, those folks actually elect their leadership as the district court judges, which there are hundreds in our state. So I think just pointing out that there are differences in even within the judicial branch and how the leadership works at different levels.
All right. Closing comments. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the comments and the questions. I think I often say that we should be about the evolution and looking at the way things are shifting and changing within our state and within our country. And the better and more informed that we are, we should make our legislation based on that information. And that's essentially what this bill does. It's providing for us to have the opportunity to seek to broaden the knowledge of this commission. And I hope for support. And I look forward to having more conversations with Representative Novotny about potential additions to the commission.
Thank you. And thank you, Professor Moriarty, for being here tonight. With that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 2956. All right, members, the next bill we're going to do is the other Representative Frazier bill, House File 2625. I will move to lay over House File 2625. Representative Frazier, I see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain that amendment, please?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Would you like to explain it?
Yes. The A1 amendment, it changes the name from Minnesota Safe Streets to Community Action. And just to give you a little bit of background on that, this bill is absolutely about ensuring that there are safe streets throughout our state, that particularly in African American communities where there has been, there's been violence and high crime rates. We wanted to change the name, from my understanding, to Community Action to show that the idea of this bill is that the community wants to take action and be involved in ensuring that the communities are safe.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now, if you want to go ahead and explain your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, this community action appropriation, you know, since the time that I've been here in the legislature, I've spent a lot of time talking to community members and having conversations around what they believe is needed for their communities to be safe. And in most cases, what I hear back oftentimes in those conversations is that, well, we need you all to invest in our communities. We don't feel and we don't see the investments over the last decades, over the last years. We feel like we've been left behind, like the resources haven't been concentrated to areas that need those concentrated resources to ensure that we have safe communities. So what I've asked them to do is, well, tell me what it is you need, and tell me how much you think you need to get that done. So this appropriation is through those conversations, through these community groups coming together and having a conversation and putting together agenda and saying that here's the action that we think we need to take in our community, and here are the resources that we believe that will be able to make us achieve those goals and make our community safe. And that's what this bill is about. I do have multiple testifiers, and so I will yield to those testifiers, and I will be prepared to take any questions afterwards.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And I have three testifiers on the list: Mickey Frost, Lisa Clemens, and Jerry McAfee. So if the three of you want to just make your way down towards the testifier table. And I'm not sure who wants to go first.
Please let me get it over with.
All right. Why don't you go first and go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
So my name is Lisa Clemens. Unlike them, I can't speak always off the dome, so I always bring notes. So I wear two hats. I am a retired sergeant from the Minneapolis Police Department, and I am also the CEO of a community outreach group. So our approach to violence is through a trauma-informed lens with a focus on the invisible suitcase. There are always signs that point to potential problems for our young people and our adults. The need to address violence is to understand that today's suspects could have been yesterday's victims. Victims whose home and community has impacted the choices they make in life. As we look at shooting victims, if we're looking at Minneapolis alone, and carjackers ages 12 to 16, which is 49%, is accountable for half the crime, for the crime in the community. 71% of the victims and suspects look like me, African American. But the issue is statewide. Therefore, our program starts with kids in elementary schools. We are dealing with a revolving door, not just adult suspects, but juvenile suspects as well. We have to be forward-thinking and innovative with our work and our program, and I believe our successes as partners has netted results in reducing violence, as acknowledged by MPD, Brooklyn Park Police Department, and St. Paul PD. The need for boots on the ground is even greater now, but the key is not just to interrupt cycles of violence, but preventing that violence before it even starts. That's the most important. In order to do that, you have to be out on the ground working with our youth, offering families, community members, and the police the help that they need to move forward. The key is creating opportunities while giving services that have a real understanding of root causes and what it takes to change lives. It is not enough to just offer resources anymore. We have to be able to patrol, to teach empowerment classes, to tutor our young people, create jobs, train, hire, and mentor. Mentoring is the key. As a means to reducing and preventing violence, our work in partnerships within our communities and the police and with the police department in the different cities has shown that work on the ground with follow-up resources and programming is effective in reducing violence. What we really need is funding to do that on a larger scale. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. And I don't
know. Can I breathe?
You did a great job. And I don't know who wants to go next, so come just introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Mickey Frost. I am the founder of the 8 to 18 Truth Center. So listen, the time has come. The time has come for a direct investment in the African-American culture. Too many times that year after year pass, other people that do not live our lives, do not understand what we go through on a daily basis, tend to try to tell us what we need to do in order to survive. Y'all don't know what we need to do because you don't live the lives that we live. Only we know what it takes to make sure that we can survive and make it through these hard lives that we're going through. There's a lot that as we sit back and we watch daily on television, I think some of us could honestly say, man, that those people are living some rough lives and going through some hell of a things. And I think if we want to be finally honest with each other and finally stop bickering and fighting amongst parties and just say, you know what, in order to work together, we need to do the things that is going to help all of us survive and make these communities a lot better. And that's what we should focus on, and that's what we should help with. A little bit ago, I heard someone say about inventing a wheel, not reinventing the wheel. Well, I think we should reinvent the wheel because the wheel that was invented didn't include us riding on it. That wheel that is out there has not worked in these communities, and I think we all know that when we sit back every single day and I watch our news across this country, we seeing that it's a group of people that are constantly losing their lives, losing their families, losing their communities, their homes, and everything else. The public is not safe. And there's only one way that we can say, you know what, let's try some new things. And I think a direct investment into these organizations, into this cause, into this bill is one step closer to saying, I really do care. I really do want to see a change in the community because I care about those people, even if they don't look like me. And I think it's time for us to do that. So I come in support because not only am I the founder of a truth center that I put my own money into to get started because I was tired of seeing young boys and girls from my community land on the streets dead with mothers crying on them. but I wanted to be able to make a change. I wanted to be able to see some things in my community be uplifted, and I seen that in our community those things aren't happening because there's a lot that don't understand that, you know, the money that is in our surplus, that's community money. That's these kids that are laying dead and the mothers that pay taxes and everybody, that's our money that we ask for. We just ask for a fair share. We're just asking to just give us some of the money so we can help our communities thrive the way some of these other communities thrive. That's all we're asking for. But we're steady met with people that believe or seem to feel as if some of that surplus money is in their actual bank accounts, and that's their money. That's not y'all's money. That's the community's money. That's all of our money. So we should be able to have access to those funds in order to make our communities a lot more better, because that's what we need. And that's what this bill is all about, a direct investment in us. Thank you.
Thank you. Please come to the table and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jerry McAfee. I pastor New Salem Missionary Baptist Church and the founder of 21 Days of Peace. I need not share with you nor tell you, because I'm sure you're cognizant of the fact of the level of violence and things that our communities and urban areas are permeated with. Since George Floyd from Minneapolis to St. Paul, we probably had over 300 homicides and over 1,500 people shot. It is our belief that a people that cannot save themselves is lost forever. You will never, ever arrest away the problem. The affected communities must stand up within the confines of their community and say enough is enough, and partner with other groups and organizations to bring peace in our community. One of the examples that I would give you, a couple of years ago when LaDavion was shot in the head, when Anaya, 8, and another 6-year-old girl died, many of the churches, communities, and agencies got together and said, listen, we've got to do something. What's tragic during the George Floyd thing that has always been lost, we've always worked with the police in our community. Charlie Adams and the Adams family has been in Northside forever and a day, so we called Charlie, Charlie, what can we do? Charlie chose 4 areas that the police could not get to all the time. He chose the areas from the community, from a mother's love to 8 to 18, to all of the different churches. We occupied Lowry and Logan, 36th and Penn, Broadway and Lindale, and another area. We occupied it for a minimum of 21 days because it is thought that whatever you can do for 21 days can be a force of habit. When I say occupy it, we would put people right in front of the door. While we're in front of that door, we're not just trying to block them, but we're also evaluating, why are you out here in the first place? How come you ain't working? What do we need to do to get you a job? Do you need treatment? And so with that, we were able to create the necessary synergy within the confines of the community to get young men and women back to good. Some we would get in treatment, some we got in housing, and some needed to be arrested. If you don't want to change, we can't stop with the nonsense and say you just got to keep going. And we're happy to report on Broadway and Lindale, we had an 18% turnaround. On 36th and Lindale, we had a 68% turnaround. On Lowry and Logan, we had a 100% turnaround. And on 36th and Penn, we had a 100% turnaround. And those figures was kept by the Minneapolis Police Department. The way they were able to get those figures is, one, you all know we got shot spotters, as well as they evaluated the 911 calls on how everything went down. It was a beautiful picture on the necessary synergy that is created within the context and confines of our community with stakeholders, churches, agencies, and police department working together for positive change. Since that time, we're located also in downtown St. Paul, downtown Minneapolis, and we can provide you data that shows that that works as well. I also need not insult you and tell you that we got a shortage of police. And if they got all of the money they need right now, they still won't be up to par because nobody's running to try to be police officers. We are ready, able, and willing to look that thing in its face and say we have to play a major role in our own survival.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. And Representative Frazier, I don't believe you had any other testifiers. So thanks again to our testifiers, not only for the work you do, but for coming here tonight. We certainly appreciate it. And we did not have any other members of the public sign up to testify, and so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to speak to the comments, some of the comments I heard from Mr. Frost.
And can I just, I'm having a hard time. I don't know if it's that mic or it might be.
This any better?
That is a lot better. Right. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
All right. So I wanted to speak to the comments, some of the comments I heard from Mr. Frost that I think I appreciate the obvious earnestness and sincerity and frustration in his voice that I'm sure is no doubt reflective of the sentiment in the community. And just try to provide some feedback from what I imagine constituents in my district would respond with in response to that. So the idea of you need to let us fix our problems, you don't understand what it's like to live the way that we live and to have the cultural experience that we have, and don't tell us what to do, don't tell us how to fix it, just let us fix it. All of that is completely relatable, right up to the point where you end it by saying, give us $35 million to do with as we please without any strings attached or explanation of how it's going to work. That's the tough sell. And as I've said in the committee before, I am eager to become a subject matter expert in how this stuff works, so that if nothing else, I can go back to those folks in my district who don't understand why they don't need these things in order to not engage in crime. How it's somehow a need somewhere else, but not a need where they live. And that it's therefore, and if that being the case, how it's their responsibility to provide those resources for other people to figure out how to manage their communities without resorting to crime. That's a really tough sell. And so my hope is, as I've expressed many times before, you know, once we get done with the session, I'm going to go back and I'm going to look through all these agendas and I'm going to be contacting all you guys because I want to get to know how it works. So that if for nothing else, the value that is there, let's say there's a shift in the party balance at some point, we don't end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair, if I may, and Representative Hudson, I appreciate that. And you often talk about your community, how your community does not understand these other communities. We do have community members here. Reverend McAfee, please come up, and if you'd like to address Representative Hudson.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Thank you so much. We are certainly cognizant of the fact of the responsibility of tracking every dollar that's spent. I'm quite sure that most of us would agree that a lot of money is spent and it don't necessarily go where it need to go to. We're in the process right now with DID, Downtown Improvement District with Minneapolis, of getting sort of like a tracking app. So one, because I know if I'm going to hire you, I need to know where you at, what you're doing, the whole nine. And they're designing an app that would be able to show and share almost like the WhatsApp. I don't know if you're familiar with the WhatsApp, but on my phone right now, we got a team downtown. Within every hour, I can tell you where my team is at, because anybody who works hard, you don't want your money just thrown and can't see any value from it. Stand up, Ill Chill. 30 years ago, he was one of them boys on the block causing all kind of havoc and chaos. We were able to get our hands on him and show and share with him a better way. See, sometimes some of the ways we were raised, we take for granted that everybody was raised like that. They weren't. And so we were able to, what we call in our community, breathe on him and get him the necessary tools that he needed to become the man that he is today. And so now he does what he saw us do with a lot of other young men. We and you all need to be able to see people. Don't put your money here and then that's it. No, 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 no. You ought to be having some other hearings on people that you can see that can testify and say that that's there. I'll say this and I'll hush. I'm sure you guys are cognizant of the murder that happened at Harding High School not long ago. Have you noticed, though, after that week, out of all those different shootings, the other two people killed, that for the last week or two, you haven't heard a whole lot? Can I share with you why? Stand up, Mickey Frost. Because what we did, we took every group that were stakeholders in those areas. I'm from Minneapolis. However, 21 Days of Peace is St. Paul as well. I called Pastor Patterson and Reverend Spence, who works with God Squad as well as the Sheriff's Department. We compare notes on everybody that's involved. Everybody that's involved. And then we divided up on who knew who. You get to that family. Bob Fletcher came in. He already had a list on them as well. What we're doing is creating the necessary synergy to partner in alleviating and eradicating the pain and problems in our community. We then take those women and get them into the system of a mother's love. Because if you do all of this and we don't heal our families, it's going to be a cycle. So we want everybody to know we will be fiscally responsible.
Thank you. And we are going to be taking some tours during the interim. So we're building that list now, and I think it would be really useful to go out into community and see some of the work you're doing. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. Thank you. My husband, who is also working towards his ordination, talks about the necessity that it is for community. And I don't care what color you are, community is how we prevent these things. And we need to make sure that we are providing the balance. And I've talked about this with some of my colleagues. Justice has two sides of a coin: accountability with repentance and restoration. Right? And that only can happen in community. And so, as I'm looking at your bill, Representative Frazier, I understand why we're doing it. I want to make sure that every community has an opportunity to have these type of programs and these type of opportunities. But we listened to the testimony of Mr. McAfee, Pastor McAfee. He talked about the necessity of police and law enforcement. And this doesn't have that in here. And so I just would want to know, we want to have the balance. We want to make sure that we have programs and communities that come together to invest in each other. Why in your bill do we also not have programs or funds to invest in our law enforcement as well?
Representative Frazier.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mueller, that's in my other bills. To put it and just to put it succinctly, it's in the other bills, House File 25, House File 855. It's in those bills, and I'm sure it will be in other bills as we go through this omnibus package budget bill. But you've heard these testifiers talk about the coordination and the collaboration that they do with police, so it's there.
My grandson.
Sorry, and we need to keep moving on our agenda. Did you have anything else? Okay. Yep, Chair Pinto.
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, Representative Mueller's question made me think about this, is that, we naturally do think of law enforcement responses, and thank you, Chair, I know that we're advancing those, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing a holistic response as well, for saying that there has to be a community response in addition to law enforcement response, and that's where I think this is so powerful, so thank you so much.
All right. Any further member discussion? Closing comments, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know, as everybody knows, targets just came out, so we've got some things to have conversations about, but I'm hoping that we can find support for this bill and for these organizations and these community members that are ready to take action to keep their communities safe.
All right, thank you. Thanks again to everybody that was here for this bill tonight. And I renew my motion and lay over House File 2625 as amended. Members, next we're going to move to my bill, House File 2609. So I'm going to turn the gavel over here. Everyone could be quiet as you're moving out of the room. We're going to keep moving. The next file bill that we have on the agenda is House File 2601. This is Representative Mueller bill. I will move to lay over House File 2609. And if everyone could take your conversations out of the room, thank you for joining us tonight. Chair, your bill is before us. There are no amendments filed on your bill, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this bill was something that I started working on it a couple of years ago after talking to an officer in Minneapolis who was telling me about an alarming number of switches that they were finding on the street. And so switches are the devices that can be used in a gun to turn a handgun into a fully automatic. And so I just, you know, started, like I said, just started working on that issue at that time, looked at the statute that regulates those kinds of devices and machine guns, and really thought that the statute seemed outdated, because at the time when the statute was written that bans machine guns and trigger activator devices and short-barreled shotguns, I don't think that those little devices were available, were on the market. And so what I wanted to do, and they're highly dangerous, and so what I wanted to do was increase the penalties for possessing those devices. And so that's what this bill does. It raises the level to what is essentially the same level as what an aggravated robbery is. And I have Superintendent Evans here is going to testify, but I also have a video just to show you how, one of these devices in action. Hopefully it's going to work.
Thank you so much. Let's see if the video works.
Do I have to do something?
No, I think Ellen already. I don't know if the
volume. Oh. Okay. It does have volume.
All right, so this right here is what we're here for today. This is your smallest machine gun.
This is the size of like a thumbtack, more or less, like a big thumbtack. And this is a machine gun.
It is indeed. Let's get some ears on.
Who's this?
Jay Jenkins is a U.S. military veteran who got into the gun business after leaving the service. He helps educate people about federal
firearms.
I'll just
say too, the volume is low, but you really, it's okay. It's more of just to see how it works than to hear what they're talking about.
It can transform an ordinary Glock pistol into a machine gun.
All right, so we got the Glock 17.
This is regular semi-automatic Glock.
Absolutely. We have a 50-round drum. We're not going to shoot all 50. We're ready to go.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and put the switch on. You want to know how long it takes for me to actually put it on?
Uh-huh.
So
converting this regular semi-automatic Glock into a fully automatic machine gun Glock by slipping in these parts. So that was like 90 seconds and you made a machine gun.
Let's see how she shoots.
Holy cow.
Yeah, we're out.
How many bullets was that?
We shot about 10 before, so that was probably about 40 rounds.
Like that?
Like that. Gone. Done.
Okay.
That's it.
Man. Just seeing like what this thing is capable of just now, like the idea.
There we go. I just wanted you to get the idea of, I don't know if I'll just leave it like that. I won't touch this computer again. Until I saw a video of it and saw it in action, I didn't really understand the gravity of it. And as you can tell too from the target that they were aiming at, they're really not very accurate either. And so super dangerous when the bullets are flying everywhere. So with that, I can turn it over to my testifier.
Thank
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Superintendent, when you get up to the desk, please state your name for the record and prepare us your testimony.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. My name is Drew Evans, Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and thank you for having us here today to testify about this bill. What Chair Moeller had just outlined in the video, I think it's something that we've been seeing with alarming frequency in our contacts in law enforcement. I've talked to you before about the BCA's assigned a dozen agents to focus on violent crime with our partners in the Minneapolis Police Department, working with St. Paul Police and others in the surrounding area. One of the things that we saw with much more alarming frequency were these auto sear switches that can easily convert much what you saw in the video, most often a Glock handgun, into an automatic handgun. And one of the things that was most alarming to us as we started seeing these is I have agents that are married to other law enforcement officers, and they brought one home and showed it to a police officer who's out on the street every single day and said, "Do you recognize this? What is this?" And he said, "No, I have no idea what it is." And this is somebody that's doing this day in, day out, across our communities in Minnesota, and still didn't recognize it. They're so small, and they're so easy to be brought into the United States, and they're primarily sent into the United States from overseas, that we are seeing this being done on a regular basis. The reason that this creates such a danger to our communities, it's obviously alarming enough if we have two individuals or one individual trying to shoot another individual. When you saw, and maybe you saw it, these were trained people with that can operate guns that you saw in the video. But as somebody that isn't trained, it's very difficult to control that handgun. And it creates a lot more danger to other bystanders and people in the area. And we've seen this on a number of different occasions. We've also seen that through impact, through enforcement, that there can be an impact on this. We made a fairly significant seizure in Minneapolis of an individual that was trafficking these into our communities that we saw a precipitous drop, but we still see these being used at an elevated level. And Minneapolis has seen a significant increase, I think it was referenced earlier, on ShotSpotter somewhere in the testimony, but they're able to track activations, and they saw a significant increase over the last year in the number of automatic gunfire, which they can distinguish between this and the other. So this is one of those additional tools to help bring, you know, violence down in our communities. As you saw, the groups that testified earlier, they do wonderful work, and we've worked with them as we're working to reduce violent crime. And there, from a community perspective, this would be on the other end of that, trying to disrupt something that's creating significant harm to our communities. And happy to answer any questions, Chair.
Thank you so much. And we don't have any other testimony, so we will move to member discussion. And I actually have a question, and I'm the chair right now, so I get to ask it. My question is, could somebody be in possession of a gun that has a switch and not know it?
So,
Go ahead.
So I will tell you the bulk of what we see, Chair and members, is a switch that is on the back of the handgun that's very obvious. So it doesn't really serve another purpose. We have not seen thus far, but there is a way that you can modify Glock handguns in particular with an internal sear switch. Very dangerous, because you wouldn't know until you pull the trigger. But it is in theory possible that you would not know if you were handed a gun with this new type of sear switch that we are learning about, we haven't really seen in earnest in Minnesota.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Kleist. Superintendent Evans or Representative Moeller, would this apply to bump stocks, and what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lena Bonnie. Sorry, no. Right, so that's a question we did have about whether the definition, so what you're seeing in the bill you have is amending Subdivision 2 of 60967. Subdivision 1, which isn't in front of you, defines trigger activator. And so I do think that we may need to, in an amendment, the next time we see this bill, have a little bit of an adjustment to that definition of trigger activator to make sure that we're also inclusive of bump stocks.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair Feist. That'll be all.
Seeing no further comments or discussion, Chair Moeller, any closing comments?
Just thanks for the opportunity to present this bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Members, thank you for the discussion. I will renew my motion and lay over House File 2601. 2609. I'm sorry, I don't know words anymore. It's a lot. At this point, we are going to move to a presentation by the Board of Private Detectives. Thank you. All right, so now we are moving on to the Board of Private Detectives, and welcome to the committee. And before you begin your presentation, I don't know if you're going to be jumping back and forth from each other, but just when you talk for the first time, please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Kate White. I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Private Detective and Protective Agents Board. And this is our chair for our board, Rick, who will also be presenting a little bit. And if you have any questions, feel free to point him his way. We are requesting just three items this year. One is the RMS system, a record management system. We are maybe one out of a few that do not have any type of record system. So what we've been incorporating and utilizing is paper. So we have paper stacks, paper folders, everything paper everywhere. And that's all of our license holders, those of our applicants, our renewals, those are our training certificates, training information. So we would like to get one place, like a repository, kind of to speak to something, where we can enable and get all of that information into one place. This will create much better customer service for us. It will create much better organization for us, and it will just benefit us tremendously. We also don't have any place to put all the paper and all the paper files that we have. We are crushing the BCA with their storage, as they are not thrilled with. But anyway, so having an RMS system would benefit us tremendously in what it could do for us just now and in the long term. The second item that we are requesting is the BCA fingerprint. Right now, our prospective license holders do not get fingerprinted. We do not get a criminal history from the FBI from them for them. We only get the Minnesota. 40% of our license holders are from out of state. So the people that are becoming business owners of these security companies, we have no idea if they have a criminal history outside of Minnesota. And again, these are your CFOs, CEOs, COOs of the departments, of the agencies that are running the security guards. So we don't want to have them have any type of criminal history. Right now, we don't have that available to us, and that's really important for us, for the safeguard of citizens, community, people that attend events, concerts, like your family members, daughters, brothers, sisters that may attend these kind of events. Lastly, we are asking for two more staff. Right now we have 2.5, and we, just as a comparison, the Post Board, we do the same amount of numbers that the Post Board does, and they have maybe 15, 16 staff members, and again, we have 2.5. So that's just kind of in comparison. These two staff members would help us immensely trying to get the RMS system, if we're lucky enough to get it, up and running, import all of our records, all of our history information that we have into that. It would also help us with our license holders, our renewals, our training that we ask for the security guards and for the company corporations themselves. They would be instrumental in handling projects that we have not been able to pursue because of the lack of staff that we have. We would also have some extra support. If a staff member leaves, it doesn't leave us just two people like we've had for the last 6 months trying to run the agency. And kind of with the uptick that we've had in the last couple of years, we are seeing many more applications come forth many more people that would like to become licensed security companies, some unlicensed security companies. This, again, will provide incredible customer service. We have a lot of people out there that call us on a daily basis wondering if some security company is licensed or not, and just general questions. So we will be able to move forward, which we really need to do, and take on a lot of things that this agency hasn't been able to do in a long time. So that was quick and precise.
All right, thank you so yes, much.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, thank you. My name is Richard Hodgson. As Kate indicated, I am the chair of the board. We consist of five people, one from each of the two major regulated industries, security, one from private detective or investigations, one BCA representative, and then two of us who are lay people. Even though I'm a lay person, I'm the old guy. I'm the institutional memory at this point, and I've been working as, and I'm a lawyer, I've been doing that for a long time. As was indicated, this is an industry that's regulating 14, 15,000 people, and it's growing all the time. There are massive shortages of staffing for this industry as well. So we are worried about people taking shortcuts. Already we have that with unlicensed activity, people who are not meeting their regulatory requirements, training their people. Law enforcement now has a major public-private partnership involving the private security world. This will allow from a public safety consumer protection, we think these proposals allow us to better do that. And so we are hoping for favorable consideration.
Thank you. Do we have any member questions? Yep, go ahead, Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you guys for your presentation. My question to you is, have you had violations, and do you fine the groups that you fine? And if they don't background check, and if it does become a problem, can they lose their license?
Do you want to speak to that? Chair Hodgson.
I'll speak to that. Thank you, Representative. Yes, there are multiple levels of response to your questions, and I'll try not to drone on like lawyers tend to do, but we have two issues.
We have lots of lawyers on this.
I know. That's why I don't think any of them take offense by me saying that.
Chair Mueller, just for the record, he said that now.
There are a couple of components. One is the unlicensed activity component, and yes, we do have many complaints that thus far, because of a lack of people, we simply can't get to them. And some of those unlicensed people, there's reasons they're not licensed, and they can't get them. We've had some apply, and they have felony convictions. They have convictions for gun violations, which our statute specifically say you can't have. Those are the ones at least try. We have multiple cases, referrals of people who are, in fact, committing the crime from our perspective of unlicensed activity, and they are a threat to public safety. We have cases right now that law enforcement's investigating that we are trying to help them with as best we can. I won't get into the details because I don't want to mess up anybody's investigation, but yes, people who are security guards who are not licensed and carry firearms and shoot people. That's happening. I'm not trying to be cagey here or keep secret sauce, but I don't want to mess up people's investigations either. And in terms of people who are licensed, are some of them taking shortcuts? We have had those kind of complaints. Are they hiring people without backgrounding? We have disciplined people for that. Are they hiring people without meeting training credentials? Yes, we've disciplined people for that as well. But right now we're complaint driven. We have to have a major problem. We don't have the capacity to ensure compliance on the front end. So it's only after something bad happens that comes to our attention that our executive can send her limited staff out to do something. So we're hoping to be more proactive on that.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, and I appreciate your candor on that. And I guess I do appreciate the work you're doing, and it obviously seems like you're overworked and need the resources. So thank you. I do think it's important because I'd rather see some of this stuff prevented on the front end instead of after an incident. And that's why I was wondering about the fine as a way to maybe hold some of them accountable. I don't know if that's in your process already or not, but thank you.
Yep, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I'm just curious. I've been working a lot with boards lately, and yours kind of puzzles me. Do you have any administrative support through MBA or through MBB or whatever? There we go, MB. Do you have any administrative support through them, or is Minute involved with you at all?
No.
Director Wright.
Sorry. No.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, the testifier, so who do you report up through the Department of Public Safety? Is that kind of how you fit into our puzzle, jigsaw, whatever we call it?
Director White.
Yes, we are under the Department of Public Safety.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything further? All right. Thank you for being here, and I think we're going to present my bill next, so if you want to just stay close by to help me out if I need it, that would be great.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So next we're going to move to House File 2510, and we're going to do a little switch of the seats again. So the next bill that we have on the agenda is House File 2510. This is Chair Mueller's bill, and I will move to lay over House File 2510. Chair, do you have an author's amendment? I see that there's an A1 amendment.
I do. I would like to move the amendment, and I can explain the A1.
Thank you.
All right. So this amendment is to address that issue that we just talked about, that Representative Witte just talked about. We had information when we first learned about the board early on in our committee process that they had 384 license holders in their database and that the Department of Economic Development had 510. So we learned about the discrepancy between people who are out there acting as private investigators or private agents, but not having the appropriate license. So what we want to do is enable the board to look into those cases, to have the staff. We did put a fiscal request in, so we're waiting on that. But we want to make sure that they have the authority to investigate those cases of people who are acting as licensed security when they really, in fact, aren't. And so really that is, I can get into more details on the amendment, but that's essentially what the amendment does.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. So so the other part of the bill, as I mentioned, the A1 amendment has to do with those situations where really people aren't licensed or we're concerned about them operating without a license. The first part of the bill, Section 1, has to do with the training that's required and making sure that those who are licensed have adequate training and that the board can ensure that they have the adequate training. And Chair Hodson can explain that part of it more.
Chair Hodson, please state your name again for the record and proceed.
Certainly. Richard Hodson, H-O-D-S-D-O-N. This was a proposal that was initially advanced last year, and then in the flurry of things it fell by the wayside. What we are seeking to do when a person wants to come work for private security or private detective company, most of the private detective companies are small, the Philip Marlowe kind of size, whereas the private security, of course, are thousands and thousands of people. So this is more of an issue for them, but it would apply to both. But you are going to hire somebody to come work private security to work in your business or establishment. By law, you are currently required to, they are required to get absolute minimum training of 12 hours, which many would say that doesn't seem very much, and you're right, but some people are not even getting that. The bill would helpfully fix that. But this is for those people who do get that training. And then now they've got it. And what we're finding is because of the staffing shortage and the free market economy being such as it is, many of these people are being lured away, just like we see in law enforcement where police departments are stealing from each other. And from an economic standpoint, what we're finding is many of the people who own these companies are unfortunately holding these people hostage. And they will refuse to even, yeah, you've had your training, but I'm not going to give you proof of it. So if you want to go work for somebody else and make another $3 or $4 an hour, too bad for you. This bill is I guess, a labor rights perspective, if I want to wear that, you know. My dad was a labor guy for 45 years, so I kind of have a little of that in my blood. But we think this is an employee rights perspective. It would allow, if I've earned the certificate, I should be able to have it. It should be my property. And if I want to take it and shop my services or maybe work a second job, many of the people in the industry may work part-time, but they could work part-time for multiple agencies if they had this ability. They could present their credentials. We see many other collateral benefits of that. Because right now, if I want to hire somebody that has been through the training, but they can't free up from their prior employer the credentials, I've got to put them through it all over again. And we've already got staffing shortages. This would allow me to hire somebody. I'd still have to refresh their background investigation to make sure that they didn't do something bad. But the training piece and many of those things would be out of the way. So I could staff up for a major event much faster. If I'm one of these people who come in from out of state or companies, and all of a sudden now we've got a national event, like the Super Bowl, where you've got to staff up hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people in a hurry, this would expedite that so we would have trained, properly educated individuals. We like that for public safety. We like that for the industry. And the fact that you now, as the employee, you own this certificate. And we don't care who pays for it. You did the work. You should be able to take that certificate and go wherever you want. I view that. That's probably my Joe Hill song coming out here. But I view this as a right of labor, and I view this as a right of management. So I just think from a labor, this is a labor relations bill. I shouldn't say that because we might have to go to another committee now. but I also think it's a public safety bill. And this will help us get staffed up. The industry has a huge shortage of people, just like anybody else does, but this will help us fix that. And this is why we hope you support the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. We didn't have anyone else sign up from the public, and so we will move on to member discussion. Any discussion? Seeing no member discussion, we will move on. Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Just thanks again for the opportunity. I keep kind of thinking, I mean, I get to decide kind of what's on before the committee, and I say thanks for letting me present the bill. So, hey, but no, thanks for all listening, I guess, and really appreciate you both being here this evening. So thank you so much. I've had to do a kind of a quick education of myself of what this board does, and it's really important work. They are small but mighty. And we want to make sure that they can keep us safe by furthering their investigations. Thank you.
Thank you. And your motion is to move this to the Labor Committee, right?
No.
Okay, then I will renew my motion and lay over House File 2510 as amended.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 2295. It is Representative Pinto's bill. And we do have the A1 amendment. So first, I will move to lay over House File 2295. And Chair Pinto, would you like to move the A1 and explain it?
I would, Madam Chair, and thank you. And it really is just, as members can see in this six-line amendment, just a couple of kind of cleanup items, and I don't know that it needs much more explanation than that, but just kind of tighten up the language a bit.
All right, thank you. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Now, if you want to explain your bill as amended.
Please. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this proposal is before us, as members are aware, I work as a prosecutor outside the legislature, and I think it can be fairly said that that a system that links pretrial detention to wealth is a really problematic system. There's a requirement under our Constitution, of course, that that cash bail be linked to reappearance, public safety, and also to securing reappearance, which sounds maybe okay in theory, but thinking about how that can work in practice, it can be, again, extremely problematic in that a person's poverty level is actually determining whether they're being held and having one of the most severe consequences that society does, which is to take away somebody's liberty, is linked to that. So, members, it seemed to me that we should examine this issue, examine pretrial release broadly, and say what are the best practices around the country. You may remember that we had the bill on Friday talking about that having to do with controlled substance use, and it seemed to me we need something similar with respect to this topic, and I'm really glad to have the Minnesota Justice Research Center be willing to work on this, and at this time I guess I'd love to call up Justin Terrell from there.
All right, Director Justin Terrell, please come on forward and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Pinto. And it's nice to see you all here. I'll keep my remarks short. It's been a long day for all of us. So, the Minnesota Justice Research Center, the MNJRC, is a nonpartisan nonprofit organization dedicated to meaningful change to Minnesota's criminal legal system through rigorous and community-centered research, education, and policy development. We center our work around exploring values, like humane and fair treatment for all, safety, well-being, and trust, and we provide our community and policymakers like yourself with information and tools needed to create a criminal legal system that truly delivers justice. We focus on research, asking hard questions, and building bridges. We believe change is possible. We invite you all to believe with us. At the MNJRC, we aim to produce rigorous and balanced research that is rooted in the needs of the people experiencing the issues we aim to understand and address. We have strong and effective relationships with community members, scholars in the academy, legal system actors, and policymakers. This is what makes our work possible, is by building these bridges across these different constituencies. At the MNJRC, we have been researching the pretrial process for the past year, and benefit from the expertise of scholars like Dr. Joshua Page and others on our research steering committee who are here with us tonight. And we're excited to embark on an in-depth study to examine best practices in pretrial processes in Minnesota and across the country. We seek to better understand how we can transform our system to ensure that after arrest and prior to conviction, communities are kept safe, defendants appear at court, and individuals are treated fairly and humanely. Our research will examine both tried and true practices and recent innovations that local, state, and federal jurisdictions have developed for reducing costly pretrial detention of low-risk defendants, monitoring and assisting release defendants, addressing victims' needs and concerns, and reducing disparities based on race and economic status. We also plan to connect our analysis with the landscape in Minnesota and to community perspectives to offer recommendations to the legislature on how we can move our system forward toward a better administration of pretrial justice. I've read my written remarks. I will just say that, you know, our organization is one that we are an organization where we want research to get real, where we seek for our research and our work to always have an impact on people's lives. And this is a serious issue that people have a lot of opinions on, and so we consider ourselves at service to the people in Minnesota to try to bring forth a study that can help people understand, keep the main thing, tell the full story, not the half, and ensure that we can put together a policy recommendation for this body that can go forward to solve the concerns and issues that have been widely expressed. Thank you for your time. I appreciate all your hard work on a long day, and I'll end my comments there.
Thank you, Director Terrell. Thanks for being here tonight. Member, we didn't have anybody from the public sign up, so we can move to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Justin Terrell. I struggle to see the utility in a study to arrive at a foregone conclusion. I mean, in both the presentation and in the testimony, we're hearing the opinion, and I feel as though I could do a fair approximation of writing this report without $1 million, given enough time, that we're going to come back with some sort of recommendation along the lines of either getting rid of cash bail or decimating the current process. Why do we need to spend this money to come up with a report that's going to tell us something that we already know in terms of what the goal here is in policy?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, Representative Eisen, if you're saying something we already know, and that means that you're endorsing the idea that there's some big problems with cash bail, I'll gladly accept that. But I guess what I'll say is, a reminder that the cash bail was actually created as something that was an opportunity for defendants, right? The option is sort of somebody gets held or not held, and this is something that is, in fact, you know, sort of the theory behind it is, in fact, it's something that is a defendant's right to cash bail. I mean, it's actually, you know, authored that way. I'll just say, so for me, I'm not quite sure what, I don't think there is a foregone conclusion. I'll say that a system, it is a foregone conclusion to me that I would hope and would expect that the report is not going to come back and say, you know, it's a great idea to link poverty and wealth to pretrial detention, right? That is a problem. And of course, cash bail does that to a certain extent. You could imagine a way in which you'd structure things that it does so much less or not at all. But I'll say, when I'm in court and, you know, you got a, and it really is, it's a sad word, but parade of people coming through, right? And this quick thing of just, you know, the dollar amounts being slapped on cases, that is problematic. It's a problematic system and structure. And I'm not saying it's problematic even because of just the linkage of the dollars to the incarceration, but just in the sense of that, figuring this out on the fly and all that can be really problematic. And of course, can be extremely disruptive for people's lives and have a real ripple effect. So I guess I would say it is much more complicated and subtle than I feel like the answer to your question that you might be expecting. And there's a lot of detail that I, as a regular daily practitioner of this, would very much like to know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, for better or worse, I sometimes just ask questions without expecting what the answer is going to be. But, you know, in this case, I guess the point I'm trying to make is it sounds like there's a lot of premises baked into the cake of what you're trying to accomplish here that presume a sort of confirmation bias that, you know, well, it's definitely bad that this idea of linking bail to wealth, our pretrial outcomes to wealth, that's we're starting with the premise that that's bad. Maybe it's bad, maybe it's not. And if you're not opening yourself up to the possibility that there might actually be some wisdom in the current process, that's a bias that seems to forego a certain conclusion in terms of what the policy recommendation is going to be. I hope I'm wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll say I would not say that there's no wisdom in the current process at all. So it's to push back on that. Yeah, no, not at all. And that's not how the report is structured. And I'll say that, in fact, if there were a foregone conclusion, you'd be seeing a bill that consists of the foregone conclusion advancing through the bodies. And by definition, some of us are trying to figure out what do we do. There are problems with the system. What do we do about them? And so and while, of course, keeping good elements of whatever we have. So, no, it's. I think this is needed from my perspective.
Director Trell, did you have a comment to add to that? I couldn't tell if you were asked. If you don't, it's fine. But.
Thank you, Chair Mahler and Representative Pinto, Representative Hudson. My brother, it's good to see you and to have this continue this conversation, which we started a few weeks ago. Yeah. One, I would just kind of jokingly reference that there's several PhDs in the audience right now who would say that this is not a foregone conclusion, and rigorous and balanced research is what our organization is about. And there are organizations who have come to a conclusion. That is not who we are. Who we are is an organization that is serious about justice, that is serious about having fair processes, making sure that we hold folks accountable, making sure that there's equity involved in how we administer justice, that we are fair and humane. That is what we are focused on. And so you can look at any part of the criminal legal system, and there is an excuse, an opportunity to interrogate and figure out, are we being more humane? Are we administering justice in a way that is aligned with the values of Minnesotans across the state? And that's what this study does. It creates an opportunity for us to interrogate that, to bring a real solution ahead in front of you. I'll avoid the politics in this room, but I think Representative Pinto spoke clearly that I think if there was an agenda around abolishing bail or whatever, that you wouldn't be hearing from me tonight. We're here to actually do the work to bring something in front of you for you all to consider and debate over. So, and we're excited to do it, and we think it's in service of the people of Minnesota.
Thanks. Members, we do have at least four members on the list with questions, and we do have another presentation at the end here, too. So, Representative Hollins.
Oh, you're whispering to me. Thank you, Chair Bowler.
You are Representative Hollins.
I am. He was whispering. Thank you, Chair Bowler, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this forward. I know we've had a lot of conversations. I mean, I know you and I personally have had a lot of conversations about this issue. And I think, you know, to some of the questions that have been asked previously, there isn't really a satisfactory answer out there right now. And I don't know that it is, like, this is the best body to make those decisions, which is why I'm supporting this bill, because I don't think that we necessarily have all of the answers, and we certainly don't have the time and capacity to do the research necessary to figure out these best practices and to figure out what is working in different places and how we might adjust things accordingly. And so I just really appreciate you bringing this forward and saying there is somebody who can do this work, and it's not us. Like, I mean, I know we'd love to feel like we all have the answers and we know what's best in every single system, but I mean, just based on the conversations between us as two lawyers coming from two different perspectives and not really knowing where to land on this, I know that that it's gonna take time and it's gonna take a lot of energy and a lot of work to figure out what's best, but it's important for the people of Minnesota to have the absolute best criminal justice system possible. Like, they deserve that. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward. And I appreciate that it's being taken off of our hands a little bit. So thank you.
Thanks. Representative Inken.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Pinto, does this have a Senate companion? I didn't see one when I was looking. But.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Inken, I feel like it does. There's so much going on right at the moment. If it doesn't, then I think it's going to be dropped very shortly. But I'm trying to remember what the situation is with that. I may need to get – that's a funny question I have to get back to you on, Representative Inken, to remind myself. I may have to – yeah, I will have to. If the website doesn't say that there's a Senate companion, then in fact there is not one. But I believe that one's going to be dropped very soon. But I have to get my head back up to speed on that.
Anything further, Representative Inget?
No further questions. Thank you.
All right, Chair Beckerford.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And I just wanted to point out a couple of things that are actually in the bill. You know, it is, I don't think there is a foregone conclusion. I think we have all become complacent with the current system as it is. And, you know, it just kind of functions. You just keep going. Like, and I've worked as a prosecutor too, and you're in that role, and we all just kind of do it because that's the way we do it. And I don't know that any of us are sure that it's actually the best way to keep people safe. I don't know that we know for sure the current system in our state. You know, and I know, especially having worked on domestic violence cases, you know, so the wealthier guy bailing out sooner for the same crime, the same charge, you know, does that make us more safe? I don't know that we know all that. I would hope that we could at least all agree that we shouldn't have people's liberty withheld disproportionately based on their access to law. And that's currently what's happening. And so I appreciate that we're gonna have some data and some research that, like, to represent Holland's point, I would love for somebody to pay me to do this, but that's not my job right now. But we have folks who have even more experience doing this kind of research. To bring it forward. And I think it's important to, you know, it's including but not limited to the use of bail as a condition of pretrial release, and that we are going to, you know, on line 1.16, how changes, not limited to analysis addressing how changes would impact public safety. You know, the tools that we use in pretrial, like, I don't know, I have never, there's not like a footnote telling you the research study you can go through that to tell you that that's the best tool to keep our community safe and balance that with people's rights to freedom and liberty. And so I'm going to sign on to this. I'm glad that we're doing it. And I just kind of wanted to make that point that the current system isn't necessarily doing us any good as it is. And so I think an attempt to move forward with legislation with the data and the research is actually the best path forward on this.
And I'll just add to, as another prosecutor throwing in my comments on here, but for me too, it's further complicating is what the Constitution, our Minnesota Constitution, has with respect to bail. So whenever we talk about this issue, I always sort of have that, like, is that, are we doing this within what's in our state constitution? Is this still, is this the right thing to do because it's in our constitution? So those are some other additional questions that I have when I look at this issue. Any further member discussion?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. One quick question. What's the budget of the Minnesota Justice Research Center now?
Director Terrell.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Novotny, our current budget for the year this year is around close to $800,000. I think $795,000 is what I think we're at. We're a nonprofit, so obviously cash flow is one of those things that it kind of comes in with projects and goes out with projects, but we are under $1 million for our budget this year.
Lead Devaney.
And thank you, Chair Mueller. So what would that $500,000 go towards?
Director Trump.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Devaney. So the way that we operate, so we're a small organization. We just got our first office at Sabathany Community Center, where I was happy to host Chair Mahler and yourself, Representative Novotny, back in on Martin Luther King Day. So we have, I think, 4 full-time staff as we're growing right now. And so a lot of what we do is hire teams, PhD students, PhDs, to help staff our projects, our research projects. I think we're at right around 8 now. And so as we're putting together the budget for this project, part of that will be hiring a team. Part of that will be going traveling to Texas, New Jersey, to study best practices. And so the budget will go towards this project primarily, yes.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Mr. Terrell. I think Representative Feist said it excellent last Friday when she said she likes data. I like data. I want to know what's going on. Right now, if you want data on bail, you have to be an expert where to look, how to find it, how to get into the files. And like them or not, the best source of information on bail going on right now in Hennepin County is Crime Watch Minneapolis. And, you know, we should have something better. Representative Hollins has a very good bill on data, on gathering of information. I've got a very similar bill that gathers almost the same information. And it's just what's done with that information once we get it. I just think that instead of kicking the can down the road 2 years, we've got the information. We've got a fairly good idea what we want. Why don't we roll this all into one publicly searchable database? I've talked to IT people from the state about having one bill. And we do one publicly searchable database. We can roll in the Sentencing Guidelines Board information, and we're done. And we can do that. So this is my way of saying, Representative Pinto, I hope you would at least look at my proposal that I'll be bringing forward now that we're in under the second. But look, I not to take anything away from what Representative Hudson said, but I think this is a bipartisan issue. We want the information. If there's this is nothing I haven't said to many of you in private, in meetings. If there is someone that is giving
disproportionate sentencing or bail, we want to know about that. Let's get this out in the open and do it as soon as we can, instead of waiting and waiting and then deciding what we're going to do and have another legislative session. We could have this up and running in just a couple of months if we put the money towards it and did that. So with that, like I said, Representative Pinto, I will put together my proposal on what we can do with bail reform and how we can make this publicly searchable. I hope you work with me on this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to all, and especially Lee Novotny for those comments. And yeah, I'd love to talk with you and work with you on that. I feel like what you're describing is a little bit different, though. So we do need to have as much information as we possibly can, you know. But I think it's not so much about individual cases, or you know, when it's saying that you know individual judges are setting bail out of whack or individual county attorneys, it's really talking about the system as a whole that we have, and is it working in the best way, as Director Terrell said, in terms of justice, safety for our communities, and respecting the rights of individuals who are charged with crimes. And so it's really about kind of what are the system changes, and receiving the recommendations and the report from this, I think, is really going to be powerful for us to make decisions next session and beyond. So I would urge your support, and thank you, Chair, for the time.
Thank you. I renew my motion and lay over House File 2295 as amended. Thanks again for being here, sticking with us, Director Terrell. And last but not least, and you're probably, I'm so sorry, we had to move things around, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission for their presentation. I know it's been a long day for everybody, but if you can just stay with us to go through this, their budget presentation, that would be fantastic. All right, so we have Kelly Mitchell and Nate Reitz with us. And so I don't know which order you're going to go, but just introduce yourself. You know the drill. And go right ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I'm Kelly Lynn Mitchell, and I'm the chair of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And with me tonight is Nate Reitz, who is our executive director. I think I'm one of two people in the state who's had the pleasure of serving the commission in two roles. I was the director before, our director writes, and I'm now the chair. So I have a unique perspective. I know what this commission can do. I know how special this commission is. I know what the capacity is. And I also know what the flaws are with our commission. And so, you know, if you think about it, our commission has been in existence for over 40 years. And during that time, the data that this staff has been able to produce has given us accurate projections of our prison populations and has given you the information that you need when you want to change the laws. If you want to create a new crime, if you want to amend a crime, we are there to give you that information to tell you how that's going to affect our criminal justice system. But we are at an inflection point. And, you know, even though we've been around for a long time, we've been affected by the pandemic, like many agencies have been. We suffer from understaffing. And we've also, I think Director Reitz and I were talking before this, like in the 12 years that we were director on the commission, there's been no additional budget request from our commission other than the normal salary increases every year. And I know that I'm fairly certain that there wasn't any budget requested, additional budget requests prior to that time. Now is the time to make the investment in the commission. As I said, we have understaffing, and we also have some sort of antiquated connections with some of our partners, and we're not utilizing data and research in the most efficient way that we can. So Director Reitz is going to go through with you the ideas that we came up with for how to improve the service for the commission and how the investments that you make can actually ensure that you have a commission that continues to give you amazing service and data for the next 40 years, just as we have done for the past 40 years. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Director Reitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nate Reitz. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm here to present the Governor's budget request for our agency for FY24-25. And we're titling this Advancing Sentencing Policy and Data for Minnesota. We're really hoping to take the work that we do and have done to the next level, and I'll unpack that in different ways. But this screen, if you can read it, shows the five budget change items. The first one we're calling maintain current service levels. That's been requested by the governor. And that's basically keeping up with inflation. And I'll unpack each of these as quickly as I can, but I also want to be mindful of the fact that these are significant requests. So if I'm going too fast or too slow, Madam Chair, please let me know. But I just want to stop at maintain current service levels. This is initiated by the governor based on the governor's knowledge of how much it costs to run an agency and how those costs go up. But that's been where we've stopped. This is my fifth go-round here in terms of biennial budget request cycles. And this is the first time we've gone beyond that first one, keeping the lights on. But we do have four more budget requests. Each one of these budget requests has been proposed by MSDC staff, has been unanimously supported by the commission, which, as you've learned earlier today, is a diverse commission, various stakeholders, but they don't always agree on everything, but they did all agree on this, that these are changes that need to be made, and they've all been supported by the governor. Expanding analysis of sentencing-related data, improving fiscal transparency and agency independence, but basically being honest about how much it costs to run our agency, fully integrating with the court information system, something we currently don't do, and I think most excitingly, comprehensively reviewing the sentencing guidelines, part one, so beginning that process of comprehensively reviewing. These are significant change items in terms of costs relative to our agency. Currently, our annual budget base is $765,000, and you see that these change items for FY24 and 25 are approximately at about that level. So we're talking about twice the budget of the agency, quite a bit less in future fiscal years, but certainly significant during the next biennium. So I'd like to explore with you what we're going to do with that money. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about our agency budget. I want to highlight that historically, the vast majority of the expenses for that you give to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission go toward paying for the staff, primarily research staff of the agency. There's six of us who work. I like to say I've got 11 bosses and 5 employees. So there's six of us that work that are paid staff on the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and most of that has been compensation. Our operating costs have been razor thin. Some of that will change as a result of these budget requests because, frankly, we're getting by on the cheap in a lot of what we do right now, particularly on the IT technology side. We really can't continue to do it the way we've been doing it if we want to take it to the next level. And I'll unpack that a little bit later. This is a graph that shows historical agency staffing. Basically, as Chair Mitchell pointed out, she's not only my boss, but also my predecessor. Kind of an interesting relationship there. But during my time, during her time, there really hasn't been an increase in the level of staffing. There haven't been any promotions in position. We've really been static. We've been keeping it lean and mean and giving the state of Minnesota the best value we can. But that's not going to get us to the next level. So let's talk about number one, maintaining current service levels. So that's essentially staying at the current level. This is the governor's estimate of what we need to maintain the same level of service that we've been providing without having to decrease employees. And what is it that we do? We review approximately 20,000 felony sentencing worksheets. So there's fewer than that actually get sentenced, but we have to review a lot of felony sentencing worksheets. We ensure that they're accurate. We ensure that everybody's being treated fairly under the sentencing guidelines at the time they're sentenced. The guidelines are confusing. We have to answer hundreds of practitioner phone calls. I was just on a conference call with an agency with an entity today that was impressed at how they called. Somebody answered. That's how we work. People call, we answer, we give them important and helpful and timely information. We analyze and report on sentencing practices. We complete hundreds of data requests and fiscal notes, and we support the commission in its ongoing policy work. So request number one is basically to maintain that, to continue to do what this small and efficient staff has done for decades. Number two is really exciting. It's expanding analysis of the sentencing-related data. So the bottom line here is it's purchasing a new position. This is a new FTE, and it's a research analyst supervisor senior. So this is a new position that we don't have right now.
Right now, I'm the supervisor of the research staff. There's four researchers. I'm their supervisor. That's not my expertise. So I was a prosecutor and a defense attorney in the Army, and I've done criminal law. I know a lot about the policy work, but I don't know the research. I know what works. I like to think that I know if the car is running well, but you pop up the hood, I have no idea what I'm looking at. So what we need is somebody who can be a supervisor in the research department, basically, and get efficiencies that we aren't able to get right now, and collect more data, or analyze more data. So right now we get more data than we have the capacity to analyze. For example, we get data on stays of adjudication. We don't have the capacity to analyze it. So it'll give us more capacity. There are some exciting things coming up. The governor's budget proposes DOC's proposed public safety data infrastructure. I'm really excited to see the data that's going to come out of that. I think that's something that we can add to the data that we analyze right now and really come up with some basically an evidence base that can help you make policy decisions. It can help the commission make policy decisions so that you're making evidence-based policy decisions. But we don't have the capacity to analyze any more data right now. We're basically at capacity right now. And the other thing, not only just more capacity that this position will bring, but it will also bring a qualitatively different kind of analysis. So right now we are engaged in descriptive statistics, basically. This will move us to inferential statistics. What does that mean? It means going from describing what's happening to what's working. And that's a really important question that you need to know the answer to, what's working. And that's not a question we can answer right now. It's not a question we have the capacity to answer right now. And we're hoping that this new position will at least begin to bring us to that. For example, recidivism research. We don't know what's happening with defendants after they're sentenced. This will bring us closer to that, to show what's working. So that's ask number two. Ask number three, it's pretty straightforward. So essentially, we get free services from the Department of Corrections, HR services, accounting services. The statute says we got to pay for those. We don't pay for them. We got dinged in an audit in 2002. We're supposed to document this unwritten barter arrangement that supposedly exists. It's never been documented. That audit recommendation is still outstanding. It's probably because we don't provide equivalent services to DOC that they provide to us. Essentially, our budget does not accurately reflect the cost of our agency because we're freeloading off of the Department of Corrections. So we need to a better practice, both in terms of fiscal transparency, so you can tell how much it costs to run our agency, and agency independence. We are kind of the rudder on the ship of the Department of Corrections. The policies that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission sets determine in large part how many people are going to go to prison. So it's really important that there be some space there between the commission and the Department of Corrections. And guess what? There is something called the Small Agency Resource Team, which is designed and built to provide those services to small agencies like ours. So we're asking for $50,000 a year to pay for that service so that the taxpayers know how much it actually costs to run our agency and so that we're independent. All right, this is a big one financially during the current biennium, fully integrating with court information systems. So each month we receive a static data pass from the Minnesota Court Information System. It's kind of like a bank statement. Each month you get your bank statement and you can see not what's happening, but what happened at a given point in time last month. What we'd like to move is instead to your app on your phone that tells you in real time what's happening in your bank. So the practical impacts of this are right now we don't know, for example, if a sentence is amended after the fact. We don't know that. We just know what happened statically when the information was passed to us. We end up asking for departure reports from judges who say, oh, that wasn't the sentence. So this will allow us to be more accurate. It will save researchers time. It'll allow those researchers to do the next level research that we were talking about. It'll give us quicker and better sentencing analysis. And it will also enable us to get at documents, which right now they don't pass documents, they only pass data fields. And this would enable us to get those things. It is expensive. Why is it so expensive? I had a talk with my Minute CIO about why does it cost this much? And basically the explanation that he gave me was we are basically maxing out our current capacity in a file-based system. What we really need to move is to a database system, which is more expensive, and it will require some significant one-time setup costs, but it will enable us to, it's basically modernizing our data infrastructure, which is required in order to do these core information system integrations. And finally, we get to the most exciting one, and I say finally, I should let you know there's several more slides, but this is the comprehensive review of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. So the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines were created primarily in 1979. In 1978, the commission stood up and started the process, and in January of 1980, they reported the nation's first sentencing guidelines. It was a pretty intensive effort, and it structures felony sentences statewide. So every felony sentence has to be held up to the sentencing guidelines. It's been updated many times, and it's been reviewed in parts, but it's never been comprehensively reviewed since 1980. It's never been comprehensively reviewed. So I think that's particularly interesting since in 1989, the legislature changed the rules. The legislature told the commission that your primary consideration in promulgating the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has to be public safety. And maybe that went without saying, maybe that was understood by some of the other directives that the commission was given, but I think it's interesting that you got a new mission in 1989, but you didn't go back and look at the document holistically and say, is this still conforming to the requirements of considering public safety first and foremost? We learned at our National Association of Sentencing Commission's conference last year, which I'm on the executive committee of. We learned about two other states that also had 1980s era sentencing guideline schemes, and we learned about their practice of doing a comprehensive review, which they've just recently embarked on. Those are Pennsylvania and Washington. And we thought, you know, this is really something we should look at doing ourselves. So there's a lot of questions to be asked here that we can see in the comprehensive review. So how can the guidelines maximize public safety? That's got to be the number one question. That's what the statute says. But also, there's a lot of interesting questions about just trends that are happening. Criminal history scores are increasing. Presumptive sentences are increasing. And departure rates are very high for many offenses. Why is this happening? We just haven't taken the time. We don't have the time to just pause and look at some of these things. What have other guidelines states learned? How can we most efficiently use correctional resources? Do the severity levels reflect the culpability and harm? We really haven't gone back and holistically looked at how we rank these offenses in terms of severity. Likewise, criminal history, the other big thing we looked at, is that balanced? Is that appropriate? We have racial disparities in our state. How can those be ameliorated under these changes to the sentencing guidelines? Do we have the right tools available to address serious and violent crimes? What have other states learned? So these are just some of the questions that the commission may look at. The timeline, so this is a limited duration project. Optimistically, I hope this is phase one of two. It's possible it'll go longer than just 4 years, but I'm hoping that the next biennium would be phase one of this. There's an anticipated phase two, and kind of phase one will determine that. So the idea is we'll be coming back to you in 2 years and asking for phase one based on what we learned in phase two, with the idea of hopefully reporting by January 15th of 2027 on this. So we do have temporary staff. These are all temporary requests, but we do have temporary staff that we would need and academic consulting services. A big chunk of money would be to hire Management Analysis and Development, which is part of MMB. They do stakeholder engagement. So this isn't something we have expertise in. Pennsylvania and Washington were really focused on stakeholder engagement. They learned as they went along that this is really critical. You've got to look at victims. You've got to look at members of the public. You've got to look at academics. You've got to look at police. So they'd be running their stakeholder engagement process while the commission on the bottom row would be running its
its review of the sentencing guidelines and basically working together to do this review. So through these one-time and ongoing expenditures, you will broaden and deepen our data analysis, giving you, the legislature, the commission, and the public better data, because you want to make evidence-based decisions, and we're trying to give you the evidence base that you need to make those decisions. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you for that presentation. And I just pulled up the sentencing guidelines from August, the most recent version, and it's 146 pages. So people might be familiar with the grids, and those are kind of the quick to guide, but the quick go-to guide, but the guidelines themselves are very complicated. And whenever I get a sentencing issue on appeal, I'm like, oh, this is, it's really complicated stuff. So anyway, thank you so much. Member discussion, questions? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Wrights, am I saying that right?
Wrights, thank you, yes.
Wrights. I was curious, you talk about the legislature changing the mission in the 80s to prioritize public safety and present that as necessitating going back and taking a comprehensive look at the guidelines. I'm sure that after this many years, there probably are some things that should be looked at and should be changed. But I'm just kind of curious, if it wasn't prioritizing public safety prior to that change, what was it prioritizing, or is there any indication of what the priority was?
Director Wrights.
Madam Chair, Chair Mitchell has an answer.
Chair Mitchell.
I do. The commission was tasked with creating the first set of guidelines in the nation. As part of that, they actually spent time figuring out what principles should underlie the guidelines, and those are actually listed on the very front page of the guidelines, and they've always been there, and public safety is part of it. But it's, you know, equity, it's fairness, it's making sure that people who have similar crimes are given similar sentences. Similar crimes and criminal history are given similar sentences. I don't remember the full list right now, but basically those principles were developed by the initial commission. They've remained in our guidelines since those guidelines were created. They were presented to the legislature when the first set of guidelines was presented to the legislature. So that's what's really undergirded our guidelines ever since they were created.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what was the shift, if any, as a result of the legislative action taken in the 80s to highlight public safety as the overriding concern?
Director
Wright. Madam Chair, question, Representative Hudson. What do you mean by shift? Shift in terms of what the commission's response was to that, or shift from the legislative point of view?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I maybe incorrectly inferred that there was some sort of shift in philosophy, guiding principle, process that took place as a result of legislative action in the 80s that centered the concern on public safety as opposed to some other prior concern or list of concerns. Is that correct, incorrect, or could you clarify?
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, I'm not sure I can speak entirely to the legislative intent. I believe the charter statute did include talk about the long-term negative impact of crime on the community. It also talked about the limited resources that the state has in terms of its correctional resources. It didn't require the commission to focus on one of those, though. It sort of laid them all out. And what happened in 1989 is it said public safety has to be your number one concern. And the original commission focused quite a bit, interesting. I mean, we could talk philosophy here, but we might not have time, but focused on just deserts and what was an appropriate penalty for a particular crime based on the defendant's criminal history. And that certainly was something that judges prior to the sentencing guidelines looked at. Public safety, I think, is more utilitarian, where it's looking at least this is my interpretation. I don't know what interpretation the commission will have, but it's looking at, you know, what is necessary to keep the public safe in terms of locking people up, deterring people, rehabilitating people, so that there's less crime. At least that's one interpretation of public safety.
And if we can wrap it up here, Representative Hudson.
I appreciate that clarification, and I'll forgo the obvious point that would be made there, but it's been made other times in this committee, but I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
All right, anything further? I am not seeing anything else, so thank you so much for being here. Again, thank you for sticking with us tonight. Thanks to all our members and staff for being here this evening, and that concludes today's agenda. We are adjourned.